Thank Leanne and Paige for singing for both services for us. Such a beautiful message in that song. How many of you like going to the movies? Show of hands. All right? At least before you had to start taking out a loan to take your family to the movies, right? I mean, as expensive as it is nowadays. I've always enjoyed going to the movies. You know, I just like to be able to escape into a story, to enjoy, you know, all the action and all the humor and all the plot twists. The romance, you know, I'll put up with it for Kelly's sake, but I've just always enjoyed going to the movies and to be able to escape in a story like that. What we're going to do for the rest of our time this morning is we're going to look at a story in Scripture that for years was just begging to be made into a movie. Just like so many of the other Old Testament stories we've looked at would make great movies. But in 2006, a pretty well-done adaptation of this story was made. Take a look at this.
An empire on the brink of war.
The money may be raised by the confiscation of Jewish wealth and property. First, we must kill them all.
Every last one of them.
An orphan who became a queen.
Suppose, my lady, a man offered you a kingdom.
The only gift I would accept is your heart.
I should give you a different name. Esther of Susa.
A secret that could change everything.
If you've revealed this to anyone, you will surely perish.
Then it perish.
This fall, she found the courage and by faith.
This is my past, my present, and my future. All of it is yours.
They found their destiny. One Night with the King.
You'd probably rather watch that and hear what I'm going to say, wouldn't you? Now, the book of Esther has all the ingredients that people down through the ages have loved in a story. And maybe more people nowadays, the things that they love in a movie. You know, it's got a beautiful and courageous heroine. It has a romantic love story. There's a deadly threat to the good characters. There's a really evil villain. You know, there's irony. There's plot twists. There's exotic places. There's justice that's a part of it. Again, all the things that people love in a story. But there is one odd part about this historically true story. And I was wondering if you noticed it this week when you read chapter 20 in your book, The Story, or maybe you went back and you actually read the story of Esther in the Bible. Did you notice what that one odd part was in particular for this story? Did you notice that the name of God isn't mentioned one time in the book of Esther? Not once. How does a book that doesn't even mention God's name end up in the Bible? That's a pretty good question. I want to continue with a movie comparison to kind of explain this. You know, back when DVDs first came out, I guess I'm dating myself here, but back when DVDs first came out, one of the things that I loved best about them was all the bonus features that were on them. They couldn't fit as much material on the old VHS tapes, but once the DVD format came out, they always put bonus features with the movie. And things like, you know, how they did all the special effects. There was interviews with the cast members and the director. And anytime you watch an interview with a director on some of these bonus features, he would always talk about, you know, why he chose certain characters for his story, or why he chose to have the story filmed at a certain time period, why he included all these different plot twists as part of the story. And it all boiled down to him wanting to get his grand vision for the story across. The director's fingerprints are all over the movie, but you would never know it from watching the movie because his name is never even mentioned in the movie. And even though God's name isn't mentioned in the book of Esther, he is the director of everything we're going to study this morning. His fingerprints are all over this, and you'll see it by the time we get to the end. So where does this story fit in the timeline of the things that we've studied the past couple weeks? Well, if you remember, what was left of the Jewish nation was conquered by the Babylonians. The city of Jerusalem was destroyed, burned, the temple was destroyed, and they were all carried away into captivity. Well, not long after that, the Babylonians were conquered by another nation, the Persians. And so now these Jews who've been in captivity find themselves under the rule of a new nation and a new king. And the Bible told us, remember as we studied, that God moved in the heart of this Persian king at the time. His name was King Cyrus. And he moved in his heart to give something pretty great to the Jews who were in captivity. He said, you can go back. I'm giving you permission to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild your city, rebuild your homes, and most importantly, rebuild the temple. And about 50,000 Jews took him up on his offer, and they went back. But there were a lot of Jews who decided not to go back. You know, Persia was a huge kingdom, huge empire, and a lot of them who were spread out, they decided not to go back. For some reason, maybe they were comfortable where they were. They had had a pretty good life where they were, didn't want to uproot and move, even though there was that option of going back to their homeland. They just decided, we're going to stay here. And among some of those Jews who decided to stay was a young woman named Esther and her cousin, who was more of a father figure, named Mordecai. And that's where our story begins. Our story opens up during the reign of a new king of Persia, and his name is King Xerxes. And he has just thrown the party of all parties. He has thrown a six-month-long party throughout the entire kingdom. You know, he's getting ready, he's trying to build support because he's getting ready to go to war, and he wants the support of his base. So he invites anybody who's anybody to be a part of this. And he wants to kind of show off his power and his strength and his wealth to everyone. So he does this six-month-long party. How do you top off a six-month-long party? Well, you throw a seven-day-long party, I guess, because that's what he did. In the capital city of Persia, he says, I'm going to throw a seven-day party. I'm going to invite everybody this time, not just the bigwigs. I'm going to invite the least to the greatest to come to this party in the capital. And he actually passes a law during this party that basically says, from what I could tell, drink as much as you want. There's no limits. I don't know if he even charged anything for the alcohol that was served. Basically, I guess you could say he served the biggest open bar of all time. And so you've got all this going on. And at the peak of this drunken party, Xerxes calls for his beautiful wife, Queen Vashti, to come and be paraded in front of all these guys that are there. This is a great example of why I choose not to drink. Because why, you know, what's the point of drinking? The point of drinking evidently seems to be to get drunk. And if you get drunk, you're going to do what he did here. You're generally going to do things that you regret the next day. And sometimes you do things that you regret for the rest of your life. And that's what happens here. Queen Vashti refuses to be paraded around in front of all these drunk guys, to be whistled at and gawked at and had rude comments made about her. She refuses to do that. Some historians say that she probably was supposed to be paraded around naked or half naked in front of all these guys. Now, whether or not that's true, it seems like Queen Vashti refuses to do this, at least for some part of it, out of self-respect. There may have been other reasons, but one of them seems to be that. I mean, and that takes a lot of courage in her place because she knows you don't obey an order of the king, there's going to be consequences. And there were. So in a drunken rage, Xerxes foolishly takes the advice of his friends, of his counselors. And if you read through what they told him at this point, it's kind of funny, especially when you think about their motive. They literally said to him, your wife is the queen. She said no to you, to what you said to do. Now, our wives are going to look to her as a role model, and now they're not going to do what we tell them to do. And every man in here is thinking, welcome to our world, buddy. You know, how's that usually any different? So Xerxes passes a law, and it kind of has two parts to it. One part of it was Queen Vashti was stripped of her title as queen, and she was banished from his presence from the kingdom. I'm surprised he didn't kill her, but that's what the Bible says, she was banished. The other part of this law was literally, it went around to the rest of the nation. It said, wives, you're to obey your husbands and do whatever they tell you to do. Maybe we could get Congress to do something like that. I don't know. Maybe start a petition for something like that. But you know, the way Persian law worked is once the king passed a law, this is the way their law system was set up, once a king passed a law, it couldn't be revoked, not even by the king himself. And so after his hangover wears off, Xerxes starts to regret the decision that he made because he misses his queen. All these other kings have queens. He doesn't have a queen now. He begins to miss his queen, but he can't bring Vashti back because it's the letter of the law, and he can't revoke that. So she's gone. So what he does is he brings up a new plan. He sends his officials out, all of his officials, out through the empire, and they're supposed to look for some of the most beautiful women in the empire and bring them back so he can choose among them. Now, if you were a young and beautiful woman at that time, and one of the king's officials came to you and says, hey, you're coming with me, you didn't have any choice in the matter. Okay, it's not like an option. Hey, I'm giving you an option to do this. No, I'm telling you to do this, and you don't have any other choice. And so if they chose you, you were carried off, and you were turned over to a guy who was named Haggai. And his main job is to basically, he oversees the selection process. I guess you could say he's the beauty pageant director or whatever, however you want to say it. He kind of reminds me he's the Simon Cowell of American Idol. Okay, he can either make you or he can break you on your way to becoming Persia's next top queen. So that's kind of who he is to me. And this is what happens to Esther. She finds her place, finds herself in the right place at the right time. And Haggai is really kind of captivated by her, by her beauty, by her personality. And so he brings her along. Well, her protective cousin, Mordecai, warns her not to tell anybody that she's a Jew. There could be a lot of complications because of that, different things involved there. So he says, you know, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew. And either Mordecai was either a gate guard or had some kind of position, official position, at the palace gate because he was always there. He was always around. And so he's kind of sticking around and trying to hear word as it's passed down to see how things are going so he can see how Esther's doing. Well, as it turns out, she and all the other candidates, they're doing pretty good because this queen in training program was basically 12 months in a beauty spa. You know, they get all these beauty treatments and all these massages and all these other things to help get them ready for the king to see them and make his selection. And it's during this time that she, again, she just really impresses Haggai. And so he gives her 7 female servants or attendants during this period of time. And he gives her the best apartment in the palace. So she already has an advantage over all the other competition at this point. It's an interesting coincidence, isn't it? Just the way things are working out, the way things are falling into place. It's almost like someone is directing all this. Well, after 12 months of pampering, it's time for the candidates to go before the queen so he can make his selection. And the instant Xerxes sees Esther, game over. You know, he's just immediately taken with her, selects her to be his queen, places the royal crown on her head, and throws another big party. What an amazing lower story event, right? What an amazing event. This kind of rags-to-riches romance is the kind of thing you only see in a Hollywood movie. But I'm sure you can tell at this point, this has not just been coincidence, okay? This just hasn't happened. Esther was at the right place at the right time for a reason, and it extends all the way down to you and me. And we'll see this in a little while. Well, not long after Esther is made queen, Xerxes promotes one of his officials named Haman to a position of leadership over all the other officials, basically second in command in the kingdom. And he passes a law that for whoever holds this position, when he comes to the city gate, you're supposed to bow down for this man. Well, everybody does it. All the other officials do it. But as we read and we see, Mordecai doesn't. And so these other guys say to him, look, you better do this or you're going to be in some serious trouble. Mordecai tells him, I can't because I'm a Jew. Now again, God's name is not mentioned directly at this point, but it's implied, isn't it? As a Jew, Mordecai has to be obedient to his faith. He has to be obedient to the law of Moses. He has to be obedient to the Ten Commandments. And they say that you are to worship no other God, have no other God before me. And Mordecai interprets that as meaning, if I bow down to another man, I am worshiping him as a god. So I refuse to do that. I can't do that. Well, when the aides and the officials report this back to Haman, he decides it's not just going to be enough to kill Mordecai. He asks and receives permission from the king to kill every Jew in the entire kingdom of Persia. Why would he overreact like this? I mean, it's just one guy. Why kill all the Jews? Well, there's a couple things here. There's some bad blood that goes back a long time, because Haman comes from a descendant, has some relatives that were part of a tribe that was there in the Promised Land when God sent the Israelites in and said, drive these people out. And so there was some bad blood that existed because of that, but also it's getting in the way of his power. It's getting in the way of his authority. If the Jews, because of what they believe, will let that override what we tell them to do, then we're going to have problems. So he says, we got to get rid of all of them. And every Jew in 127 provinces of Persia is targeted to be killed, including those in Jerusalem, because it was a province of Persia at this time. It shows you how terrible it would be to live under a dictator in a country where there is no respect for your beliefs. There's no respect for your conscience. You know, you obey the law, even if it violates that, or watch out. Well, to determine this time when they're going to kill all the Jews, Haman gets his officials around him, and they literally roll dice to pick the day. Again, just another sign of how flippantly they treat life, how it's not sacred to them at all. So they just roll these dice, and they pick a day that's about 11 months away. And King Xerxes makes an order, and it's sent out to everybody in the region in the Persian Empire. Well, not long after this, Mordecai sends word through one of Esther's assistants about her about Haman's plot to kill all of the Jews. Evidently, she hasn't heard of it at this point, at least from what we can tell. And so he also sends along the copy of the edict that he got from the king that describes what's going to happen on that day. So he sends that along as well so she can read it. Do you remember Queen Vashti? I bet Esther did right about now. Because as much as she wanted to go to bat for her people, she probably thought that this was going to be hopeless. Because in that culture, no one approached the king. Nobody did. Nobody went into his court unless you're summoned to go into his court. And the law of the land was, if you go in there without being summoned, you die. And so Esther sends word back to Mordecai, kind of saying, I'm sorry, I don't know what I can do about this. I don't have that kind of access. Now you would think that's kind of odd. She's the queen. She's married to this guy. Why can't she talk to him? We got to remember, he's got hundreds of wives, really. And she even mentioned in there, the last time she had been summoned was about 30 days ago. So it wasn't evidently kind of rare, the interaction that she was able to get. Well, that's when Mordecai must have gotten a glimpse, I think, of God's upper story here. Why had they stayed behind in Babylon when all their friends went back to Jerusalem? Why did Queen Vashti refuse to obey the king's command, which led to her losing the crown, which opened up this beauty pageant, which Esther was picked for? She rose to the top quicker than anyone else, and now found herself in the position of queen. And why did Haman have to have it in for the Jews? What Mordecai says to Queen Esther reveals, through a question, why all of these seemingly random events occurred like they did. And this is what he says. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? How could Mordecai be so confident that God was going to deliver? I mean, he's very confident in what he said there. It's going to happen one way or another. How could he be so confident? Because he knew and he remembered what God had already spoken through the prophets, that through the Jewish nation, in the town of Bethlehem, a Messiah was going to be born for the world. He remembered God's promises, and he trusted God's promises. It didn't matter what the circumstances in the lower story looked like for him and for the Jewish people. That's what God said he was going to do, so he's going to do it. And Mordecai gives three reasons why Esther should risk her life to intercede for the Jews. First, he reminded her, look, you're a Jew. I know the king may not know it right now, but you're a Jew, so you're going to be in the same boat, most likely. And second, again, like we already talked about, he showed great trust in God's promises and what he said was going to happen. And I love the way he said it to her, because he basically says, you know, look, God's going to save his people, and he's going to save us. You can intercede on our behalf or not. Whether you do or not, he's going to save us. But here's the thing, you can be a part of it. You can be a part of what's happening here. And I think that's a powerful lesson for us today. God wants to accomplish his purposes through us. He wants to use us in this world to share his word, to accomplish his purposes, to stand for what's right, to stand for what's just and true, and what is according to his word. He wants us to do those things. But the thing is, his upper story is still going to be carried out whether or not we do it. He'll just choose someone else if we decline. Now, a lot of people may like the sound of that idea. You know, he's going to do it whether or not I do it, so just let somebody else do it. I hope that's not our attitude about things, because we will miss so much. If that's the choice we make, we will miss out on some of the greatest spiritual blessings, some of the greatest spiritual growth in our lives, some of the greatest eternal rewards that we can imagine if that's the choice that we make. Mordecai's final argument to Esther is to basically suggest, look, the trouble the Jews find themselves in right now, I think it's very likely is the exact reason why you are where you are. It's why you are in the position you're in. If we could consistently hold that kind of view about wherever God has placed us right now, right where we find ourselves, it may not be where we want to be, okay? It may not be the job we want right now. We may be in some tough circumstances right now, okay? And we tend to always want to look to the next best thing, to the greener grass somewhere else. But if we would adopt this attitude, wherever we are right now, that we are there for such a time as this. Because God wants to use us right where we are. Not one day, not someday, right now. So are we open to that? Are we open to that's how God wants to use us? After hearing Mordecai's arguments, Esther agreed to go to the king and to try to intercede. And this is what she told Mordecai, probably some of the most famous words in the Old Testament. I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. You can imagine the emotions that she's going through at this point. You know, even if the king spares her life, she's still putting her position as queen and relationship with the king in serious jeopardy. I mean, look at what happened to the last queen. And the fact is, he doesn't know she's a Jew yet. And there's an order out there by the king's decree that all the Jews are going to die. She's risking it all by doing this. When the king sees Esther come into the court, you know, unannounced, not summoned, you know, you could imagine the tension that was in that place. But the Bible tells us that he was pleased with her. And he extends his royal scepter, his golden scepter to her, which was basically a sign was, you know, it's okay. You know, you're okay, I accept you, I'll let you come in. It seems like Xerxes realized that Esther's visit wasn't taken lightly. I think he can tell that she's put some thought into this. And he's so moved with compassion for whatever would prompt her to take such a great risk that he says, request whatever you want, even up to half of the kingdom can be yours. You know, that's exactly what I do with Kelly. When she comes into my office unannounced, without me summoning her first, you know, she comes, I don't have a royal scepter, but I've got this royal pen here that I think all men get this when you get married. But she comes in and I'll just extend the pen to her. And I say, you know, it's okay, even though I didn't call you in first, you can enter. And because I love you, you can ask for whatever you want, even half of my vastly enormous estate can be yours. You know, that used vehicle with about 100,000 miles on it. That little dog of ours that vomits on the carpet about once a week. All of that can be yours. You can thank me later. You may go. Yeah. Now, if all guys are honest, ladies, don't you just love the fact that you live in this century and not in this time? Because if most guys were honest, they'd say that you probably hold the scepter nowadays, not most of the guys. But, you know, that's the way things tend to work out. Now, Esther didn't come right out and say to the king what was on her mind. She invites Xerxes and Haman to a banquet that she had prepared. And although it may seem like she's getting cold feet at this point, why not go ahead and say it? You take the big step of going into the court. It's been okay. Why not go ahead and say what's on your mind? Well, she's not getting cold feet. She's got a plan. If you read through, it says she had already prepared this banquet. It wasn't a delay here. It wasn't a last-minute idea to buy some time. She wanted to get Xerxes and Haman alone for this conversation. Well, when the meal was finished, the king asked her again what she wanted. But she changes the subject. And she says, hey, I want to invite you and Haman tomorrow to another banquet. Now, at this point, I think she may have gotten cold feet in this situation. But I still think God's hand was guiding what was happening here, especially when you look at what happened in the next 24 hours. Now, Haman leaves the banquet feeling pretty good about himself. I mean, who wouldn't, right? You just had a private dinner with the king and queen, and now tomorrow you're invited to another one. Nobody else has that kind of access and influence. So, you know, he's in pretty good company there. So he's on cloud nine, and he's feeling great. He's walking out of the palace. He comes to the gate, and then it's all gone. Because there's Mordecai, still refusing to bow down, still refusing to submit. And so all the joy that he had is now turned to anger. And he gets home and he gets his wife and all his friends around and he goes through all these reasons why he should be the happiest man in the world. But he confesses to them, I can't be happy because I got this guy here at the gate who won't submit to me. He won't do what I tell him to do. He won't bow down to me. What a powerful lesson about what pride can do to us. I mean, with all that Haman had, he couldn't find happiness because of one guy who he didn't even like in the first place wouldn't submit to him. We've got to look out for pride in our life. It can destroy us. It can destroy the people around us. Pride is a terrible thing. We've got to look out for it. Well, his wife and his friends, they end up falling into this same prideful trap that Haman has. And they encourage him, look, you just need to kill Mordecai as soon as possible. You know, I know there's this law that says about 11 months away, this can be done. You need to kill him now. Now, one of the common forms of execution by the Persians at that time was to impale people on long poles. It was just one of the most common forms of execution that they had. So his wife and his friends tell him, look, you need to build one of these. But not just your average one. You need to build one that's higher than everybody else's so that everybody will see when you impale Mordecai on that, that's what happens to those who don't obey, who don't obey what the king says, who don't kneel to our power. Well, this was the first important event that happened because of Esther's second delay, what we might call a second delay. You'll see why in a little while. The second important event that happened during this delay dealt with King Xerxes. Now, after that banquet, he couldn't get to sleep. Probably because he's still wondering, what in the world does Esther want? You know, what's on her mind? And so he has a servant come in and start to read to him from the history books of Persia. Now, you can imagine, that's about as exciting as reading the phone book. So you could see how it will help put you to sleep. But the thing is, this servant happens to open up just to the spot of this history and starts reading, and something catches the king's attention. As he's reading to King Xerxes from these history books, he reads about an assassination attempt on his life that Mordecai found out about and stopped from happening. And he realized that nothing had ever been done to reward Mordecai for this act, for his bravery, for him stepping in here for the king. And so he immediately calls out for one of his officials to come so he can talk about how to honor this man. And guess who happens to be the first official to respond? Haman. You know, without giving him any of the details, the king doesn't tell him, hey, I'm doing this for Mordecai. He just says, how can we honor someone? What's a good way to honor someone who's done something great for the king, for this kingdom? Now, Haman, as bloated as his ego was at this point, thinks the king is talking about him, you know, that he's the one. The king's talking about supposed to get rewarded and all this stuff. So he starts to lay it on really thick about all the honor this person should get, all the rewards and the wealth that this person should get. I wish there was a picture in the Bible, an original picture of Haman's face when the king told him, "That sounds really good. Let's do that for Mordecai." And you're going to be the one who carries this out. You're going to be the one who brings him all these honors, who's going to go around the kingdom announcing to everybody else how great a man Mordecai is. I wish we could see the look on his face. You can't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. You know, where an unbeliever, in this point in the story, an unbeliever would simply say, "Well, there's been a lot of just amazing coincidences that have happened." Where an unbeliever sees that, we as followers of Christ must recognize that this is the hand of God. This is God's direction. You know, it was God who troubled the king's sleep. And of all the sections of history that servant could have opened up and started reading, he just happened to open up to the part about Mordecai. It was God who directed that. It was God who directed the timing of Haman coming in to talk about that whole situation. What many call coincidence is simply when God chooses to direct from behind the scenes. Well, the final pieces of our story are about to fall into place. King Xerxes and Haman come to the second banquet that Esther has prepared. And I just want you to listen from Esther chapter 7 to what unfolds next.
"So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And as they had drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked,
'Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted.'
Then Queen Esther asked,
'If I have found favor with you, this is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet.
What is it?
Because no such distress would justify disturbing the
king." King Xerxes asked Queen Esther,
"Who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing?"
"An adversary and an enemy. This vile Haman."
Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got from the ring, left his wife, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed,
"Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?"
As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they cut Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said,
"A pole reaches to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king."
The king said,
"Impale him on it."
So they impaled him on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided.
And the phrase, "and they all lived happily ever after," except for Haman, could probably be used in this story. Mordecai was promoted to the second command of the kingdom, a position Haman used to have, and all the Jews were saved. In fact, they marked on that time, began a celebration that continues to this very day. On March 10th, the Jews celebrate every year a feast called the Feast of Purim, which means the Feast of the Dice. Remember when Haman rolled those dice to decide the day they were going to die? It's a reminder to them, and really a reminder to us, that God's upper story isn't ruled by chance. You're not here by chance. The things that happen in your life don't happen by chance. God is in control. Even the tough things.
are part of God's plan. There's even a purpose in those things. What if your greatest fear, what if your heaviest burden has been given to you for such a time as this? You may never be in a position where obeying God is a matter of life and death. I pray that we aren't. I pray that none of us in this room are ever in a position where obeying God is a matter of life and death for us. The worst thing that can happen to us, for most of us, at least at this point, is that we face a little ridicule. People may think we're fanatics or extremists if we go and participate in the March for Life in Washington, D.C. Your colleagues at work may call you a Bible thumper if you carry the Word of God with you and you have your a quiet time at work during the day at some point. You may get laughed at and you may get mocked by students and professors when you bring your Christian worldview into classroom discussions in high school or in college. Other people may not like it if we go to a school board meeting and we politely and gently share our concerns about how some of the history curriculum is simply erasing God from our past, erasing the godly heritage of our nation, or how our science books, in some cases, don't even give creation as an option, won't even talk about intelligent design as an option for how all things came to be. We may be labeled haters of women's health and uncompassionate when we oppose an unjust health care law that forces people of faith to ignore their beliefs, to ignore their consciences in order to comply with the law. I still believe that God speaks to us using those gentle nudgings and those whispers from behind the scenes. I believe that he offers us the privilege of standing up for his name and what many in the world would call, you're nuts, you're crazy, you're a fundamentalist, you're an extremist, but what we call loving acts of obedience. The question is, will you allow God to use you in those situations? He's going to accomplish his upper story with or without us. But just imagine what can happen in our families, in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our nation, in our world, if we would adopt the attitude that Esther had. I will go. I will stand. I will speak. And if I perish, I perish. If they laugh at me, they laugh at me. If they mock me, they mock me. If I'm an outcast because of it, then I'm an outcast. Whenever Satan comes up with a new strategy for evil, like he did in using Haman to kill all the Jews, we got to remember, God is already miles ahead of him. Miles ahead of him. He's worked it out all behind the scenes. Remember, they are not equals. God, you know, it's not like Satan is God's opposite equal. They're not equals. It's not like the jury is still out on who's going to win this thing. I think the perfect example, and as we close today, I want us to think about this. The perfect example of this is how God worked through the cross. Satan thought that through killing the Messiah, he'd won. He thought, I did it. You know, I beat God. But God turned that plan around because he had already planned that this was going to happen. He turned it around and used it to seal both Satan's ultimate defeat and our salvation. And one terrible event, yes, but it was a wonderful event at the same time. The question is, are you going to accept his role for you in his upper story? Will you say yes to becoming a new creation through what Jesus has done on the cross? And if you're already a believer, will you serve God with the kind of commitment that Esther had? We're going to sing our